Over NBC's Coast to Coast network of independent and affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Before presenting today's five speakers on Should a United Nations Army Enforce a Partition of Palestine, may we remind you that you may subscribe to the Roundtable pamphlets for 1 year for $3. Carl Sandburg says that he has subscribed to the Roundtable pamphlet so that he can have a record of the 52 weeks a year discussions. He says, if it happens that I miss a broadcast, that pamphlet is convenient. You will find each week's 32-page pamphlet with its supplementary documents, maps, illustrations, reading lists, questions, a most valuable, authoritative, up-to-date publication. For $3, you will receive over 1,500 pamphlet pages in the next 52 weeks. To subscribe, send $3 to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. We now present John A. Wilson, Professor of Egyptology of the University of Chicago. Mr. Wilson.
Does the partition of Palestine mean war? Should the United States propose a United Nations army with American soldiers and guns to enforce the partition of Palestine? A decision on Palestine must be made now. Next Tuesday, the Security Council will begin debate on whether a United Nations armed force is needed there. The United Nations Palestine Commission has just recommended the creation of an adequate non-Palestinian force. The Arabs are making daily attacks. The British troops are leaving on May 15th. And the United States, which proposed partition, must now decide what to do. Today's University of Chicago Roundtable on Should a United Nations Army Enforce Partition of Palestine presents five independent statements from different points of view on this problem. Bartley Crum of San Francisco, Walter L. Wright of Princeton University, Reinhold Niebuhr of Union Theological Seminary, myself, John A. Wilson of the University of Chicago, and the Right Honorable Arthur Creech Jones, the Colonial Secretary and British Cabinet Minister, will make successive statements. We first hear from Bartley Crum, a member of the Anglo-American Palestine Commission, and author of Behind the Silken Curtain. To present Mr. Bartley Crum, we take you now to San Francisco.
I want to make three points today. First, that the Palestine question is no longer a Jewish question. It is a world question. It is one which tests whether the United Nations will survive. Second, I favor strongly and bluntly a United Nations force, a United Nations army strong enough to carry out and to enforce the United Nations decision on Palestine. And third, the arms embargo of the United States should be ended. This arms embargo merely means that the Jewish community in Palestine will be and has been deprived of the right to defend themselves. On November the 27th, 1947, the United Nations, by a two-thirds majority of the General Assembly, with Russia and the United States in agreement for the first time, adopted the partition proposal on Palestine, giving recognition to the international and worldwide obligation to the Jews. Palestine is, in fact, the showdown as to whether the United Nations can continue as a force for the preservation of world peace. Clearly, such force is now necessary to show the deluded and bankrupt Arab leadership that the democracies of the world mean business. It is, of course, for the United Nations themselves to decide how they may best protect the peace of the world. For it was for this purpose that they were created by the nations of the world. There are alternatives which may be proposed by individual members of the United Nations. Next Tuesday, these alternatives will include a force made up of the major powers, or perhaps a force made up of the smaller powers, or direct recruitment of individuals from all countries interested, and many other alternatives. My own view is that the best solution would be a United Nations force consisting of token troops of the smaller powers. For example, those that are now in Germany, the Dutch, the Belgians, the Danes, the Czechoslovakians, to stop this aggression against the United Nations. The use of men from the smaller powers would tend, I think, to eliminate the charge that the United Nations is merely the clearinghouse for power politics. The Arab High Command has stated categorically that it will fight against the partition of Palestine as decided by the United Nations. And they have thereby challenged the United Nations itself, just as Japan in 1932 flouted the League of Nations and thus brought about its destruction. The Arab High Command is at this time seeking to organize Arab armies to commit positive acts of aggression in Palestine. But Palestine has a people's force known as the Haganah. This word means defense. Haganah, which has vast manpower, can protect the boundaries of Palestine and the people in that country, whether they be Arabs or Jews, against predatory guerrilla action. And I hope that Sir Arthur Creech Jones, the colonial secretary of His Majesty's government, will persuade that government to give more than lip service to the decisions of the United Nations, and particularly to the Palestine decision. Whatever forces the United Nations must employ to meet this situation will have the complete assistance of Haganah. Manpower requirements for these United Nations forces obviously are not great, but certain requirements are clear, and these are the requirements of equipment and military strategic personnel. Today I have made three points. First, that the solution of the Palestine question and the survival of the United Nations are inseparable. Second, that just as every city needs policemen, so the United Nations needs force to carry out its decision. It may not be necessary to use that force, but it should and it must be available. And third, that the arms embargo of the United States should be lifted, and lifted in favor of any power which is supporting the United Nations decision on Palestine.
We return you now to Chicago.
Thank you, Mr. Crum. I now present Walter L. Wright, formerly president of Robert College, Istanbul, Turkey, and now professor of Turkish language and institutions at Princeton University. To present Walter L. Wright, we take you now to New York.
My answer is an emphatic no. To try to carry out the existing partition plan by force of arms would be like pouring gasoline on a flaming fire. This plan is not a settlement, but an irresistible invitation to war. Fortunately, it's only a plan, a recommendation by the United Nations Assembly to the Security Council. It is not a law. The Charter of the United Nations makes absolutely clear that the Assembly is not a legislature. The Security Council has the legal right to disapprove and scrap this unjust and unworkable plan. In recommending partition, the Assembly, urged on by our government, has been false to its basic principles. Article 1 of the Charter states, quote, "The purposes of the United Nations are to develop friendly relations among nations based on respect for the principle of equal rights and self-determination of peoples." The partition plan denies the right of self-determination to the majority people of Palestine. It orders one-third of the Arabs, 400,000, to accept the rule of a proposed Zionist state with 600,000 to 700,000 Jewish inhabitants. Surely the Jews know better than most peoples how minorities feel. How can they expect the Arabs to accept that fate without resisting? Can't they see behind this proposed Arab minority the other 800,000 Arabs of Palestine and the 40 million Arab sympathizers of the Arab League states? Desperation and blazing nationalism apparently blind the Zionists to these facts. But we Americans cannot afford to be so blinded. No. The existing partition plan represents the exploitation of the United Nations by a great power, our own government, catering to the insistent clamor of the Zionist pressure group in our domestic politics. To prostitute the United Nations for a few thousand votes is the surest way to discredit it. Supporters of partition assert that the future usefulness of the United Nations requires the use of force to implement the plan. Nothing could be more false, more wrong. Such use of force would contradict the basic principles of self-determination. Mere announcement of the plan has already brought war to Palestine. The purpose of the United Nations is to promote peace, not merely to have its Security Council agree with its General Assembly. The hope of mankind for a just and lasting peace is at stake in this issue. But those misguided persons like Mr. Crum, who urge use of armed force to carry out the partition plan, are perhaps unwittingly striving to blast that hope. The Security Council must now decide what to do. What are the basic facts and considerations on which a just decision must be based? Palestine contains two hostile nationalities, each burning with the fierce fire of a new nationalism. Each wants to rule the whole country. Each will fight to escape rule by the other. Each is too numerous to be moved bodily from the country, and there are no invitations for either to go elsewhere. The world cannot let either annihilate the other. Palestine cannot be divided into two workable independent states. No possible line can be drawn to separate the intermingled peoples, any more than Chicago or New York could be split into independent states of Methodist, Baptist, Catholic, or Jewish population. Self-government and peace can come to Palestine only when both peoples, Arab and Jewish, give up the ambition, which each now has, to rule arbitrarily all or some of the other people. Use of United Nations force, of blood and iron, to carry out the proposed partition can only postpone the real settlement. The United Nations must, according to its own charter, make every effort to negotiate a peaceful agreement. I believe that it has a chance now, for both Arabs and Zionists must have learned during the recent bloody months what a vast expenditure of blood and treasure would be required to subdue the opposition of the other to its rule. The 1,000 lives already lost have, I hope, brought the leaders of both nationalities to their senses. The Security Council would therefore make the most determined possible effort to secure a compromise in the form of a federal state. Once before, such an effort almost succeeded. The world cannot afford to have it fail now. This is the road to a settlement, to peace in Palestine, to peace in the world. A final word about Turkish reactions to American policy toward Palestine. The Turks are completely bewildered to see us spending $500 million to protect small nations like their own from the USSR, while at the same time, we are repudiating the rights of their Arab neighbors and jeopardizing the future of the United Nations. They can perhaps be excused for not understanding the power which a small but well-organized pressure group can exert on American foreign policy. We Americans have no excuse.
We return you now to Chicago.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. The University of Chicago Roundtable now presents an eloquent voice of Protestant Christianity, Reinhold Niebuhr, Professor of Christian Ethics at Union Theological Seminary, New York. To present Professor Niebuhr, we take you now to Philadelphia.
The violence of the Arab opposition to the United Nations policy of partition in Palestine, a violence which neither thoughtful observers nor initiators of the policy quite anticipated, seems to have two primary causes. The one is the Arab fear that the settlement reached by the United Nations is not a final one, but that the establishment of a Jewish state will become merely the basis for further ventures against Arab sovereignty. If anything can be done to allay Arab apprehensions for the future, it should be done. In that sense, we ought to attempt conciliation. It would be valuable to bring the two parties together and to seek for agreements which would either remove fears which have no justification or to destroy any possible justification for such fears. Conciliation cannot mean, however, reopening the question of the settlement itself. It must be remembered that the binational state, which was the one alternative solution for the problem, was found impossible for many reasons, one of which was the unwillingness of the Arabs to give the Jews any freedom in regard to immigration, and that is a point upon which the Jews can simply not yield. Reopening the settlement reached by the United Nations would be the more futile now because the Arabs, having noted the equivocation in our policy, would be less rather than more inclined to yield upon this point. It is this equivocation which is the second cause of the fury of the Arab attack upon the United Nations settlement. As long as we remain hesitant and inconsistent, neither conciliation nor defense measures will avail. For our double attitude has aroused the hopes of the Arab world that a sufficiently strong show of resistance may persuade us and the United Nations to reconsider the settlement. Most of us who are not privy to any state secrets can only infer the reasons for the hesitancies and the lack of consistency in our policy. It is probably due to the fact that we supported the policy of partition for moral and political reasons and have apprehensions about it for strategic reasons. Apprehensions naturally expressed primarily by our military. The Arabs have us by the throat, or, to be more exact, by the pipeline, on resources which are regarded as essential to our defense in the Mediterranean. In addition, the oil from the Mediterranean required for the European recovery program has given them another counter against us. While it is the business of soldiers to prepare for all eventualities, it is the pathos of purely military strategy that it often hastens the catastrophe for which it is making preparation. In this instance, the doubts and hesitations which have been introduced into our policy by military men may prompt a major catastrophe in the Near East. If the purpose is to court such catastrophe in order to have the whole settlement reconsidered by the United Nations, that means that we are risking the very existence of the United Nations. For it is not at all certain that any authoritative decision could come out of resubmission, and it is highly probable that continued confusion on the issue might be a body blow to the prestige and the life of the United Nations. It is the considered opinion of many people who are close to the scene at Lake Success that the United Nations would be thrown into complete confusion by resubmission. We must, therefore, reassert our loyalty to the settlement previously reached, and even more important, we must implement it by adequate defense measures. The peace of the Near East ought to be preserved by a United Nations force. Ideally, such a force should be composed of contingents from the smaller and more disinterested nations. But they seem reluctant to assume this responsibility for rather understandable reasons. The next best policy is, therefore, the most rapid possible recruitment of a voluntary force, also drawn primarily from the smaller nations and equipped by the United Nations. The moderate arming of the Jewish state must go hand in hand with this policy of an international defense force. In fact, both the Jewish and Arab states should have equal rights of self-defense, but in any case, the United Nations force should have predominant power. In order to carry out the proper defense measures, Britain's inexplicable policy of not allowing the United Nations Commission into Palestine until 2 weeks before the expiration of the mandate must be overruled by the United Nations. One rather suspects that Britain would never have dared to take such a position if it had not shrewdly guessed that we have two minds on this subject and it was worth her while to be the servant of one of our minds. In short, the issue really lies with us. If we can achieve a consistent policy, there is still hope. If we do not, the confusion in our own minds will spread from us into the world. We are playing with fire in this confusion, and we could inadvertently light a world conflagration.
We return you now to Chicago.
Thank you, Mr. Niebuhr. And now, my personal answer to should a United Nations army enforce partition of Palestine. First, Palestine cannot survive economically if it's carved into two zones. Second, a policing and occupying army does not bring a country together. It rather holds it apart. Let's look at the other countries which have been carved apart and held apart by force. Germany and Austria have been arbitrarily divided into zones, cutting off the normal and traditional flow of goods. Four enforcing armies hold Germany apart and prevent normal economic life. In Asia, Korea is in exactly the same situation, cut by an arbitrary line into two zones. A drastic surgical operation divided India into a Muslim state and a Hindu state at the cost of perhaps 250,000 lives. Partition is bad economy in Germany, Austria, Korea, and India. It will be bad in Palestine. Imagine American and Russian military contingents side by side in Palestine. Would they bring the country together, or would they push it further apart? How soon could they leave? It is not a pleasant outlook. American and Russian troops eyeing each other in Palestine for our lifetime. Everyone who argues the population increase in Palestine has done so on the basis of potential water power there. Well, certainly, A Jordan Valley Authority like our TVA would be a marvelous asset to Palestine. But it would do the Jews no good so long as force holds the land apart. If Jewish Palestine is to receive 400,000 more immigrants, it must be industrialized. Partition means trying to industrialize without any raw materials or any power whatsoever. The raw materials and the water power of the Jordan Valley are in the proposed Arab state. Jewish Palestine would be doomed to become an international ghetto dependent upon the charity of British and American Jews forever. Is this just to the honest aspirations of the Jews of Europe and the Jews of Palestine? No, partition will not work. Well then, what is the answer? The United Nations should issue a ceasefire order immediately to the Arabs and Jews, and Palestine should be reconstructed as a single federal state on the pattern of Switzerland, with respect for the different peoples, providing local autonomy of the Jewish and Arab cantons on religion, education, and municipal government, and unity in economic development and foreign affairs. But that is not enough in itself. Unity in foreign affairs means that immigration of Jews in Europe would be small. We need an international relocation authority, with the United States taking a generous initiative in order to receive homeless Jews into this country and others. If Jews are assured of a welcome and a new start in life in the United States, Canada, and other countries, then it will be unnecessary for them to crowd into the slum of a partitioned Palestine, a policed ghetto, which is the only refuge of world Jews. This is a world problem, and it must not be confined to Palestine by the force of an international army. So much for my personal statement. We are now privileged to present the official viewpoint of the British government through a statement by the Right Honorable Arthur Creech Jones, the Colonial Secretary. To present, Mr. Creech Jones, we take you now to New York.
I want to explain the British point of view. For the past 25 years, we have tried to discharge the obligations of our mandate, that is, to respect and preserve the rights of the Arab community, and at the same time, to fulfill its proclaimed object of establishing a national home for the Jews. We've made some mistakes, perhaps, but we believe that the British contribution is vast towards the Jewish home and the development of Palestine and the Middle East. The mandate, an international instrument taken up by us with world approval, was, however, inherently contradictory, and neither Jews nor Arabs felt that their interests and aspirations were adequately satisfied. We did our utmost to reconcile these differences within the framework of a unitary state in Palestine, which was the only line that the mandate permitted. But the conflict smoldered, and from time to time was fanned into flame, now by the Arabs and now by the Jews. It was inevitable that immigration should be controlled and other disagreeable regulations laid down in the mandatory search to fulfill the mandate's terms to Arabs and to Jews alike. The difficulties of the mandatory, however, were made still worse by the failure of the people of Palestine to build up central representative government. It was not the fault of the British government that the administration had few roots in the life of the people, when time revealed more thoroughly how unworkable the mandate was. Meantime, many of our critics, though having no responsibility themselves, took active steps to increase the difficulties of the administration. The search for a basis of accommodation was made repeatedly with the two communities, but all in vain. And finally, the United Kingdom had no alternative but to invite the United Nations to study the problem and try to solve it. We offered the United Nations the experience and information we had. We felt that they should be free to find, if they could, the solution which had eluded us. Therefore, we refused to prejudice the discussion by suggesting any solution of our own. The press for one policy rather than another would have created further suspicion of our intentions. We were obliged to refuse any longer to hold the ring while Arabs and Jews remained in conflict. We hoped that our withdrawal would bring the two communities to a solemn realization of the disastrous prospect if there were no reconciliation. We therefore announced the mandate would be terminated on May 15, and all our forces withdrawn from Palestine by August 1. A policy of partition was determined by the United Nations last November as the best course for Palestine, and a commission appointed to implement it. My government had already declared that, unless there were agreement between the parties, the British forces could not be used to coerce either Jews or Arabs to accept any settlement which one or the other violently resisted. We had repeatedly given warning that whatever policy was adopted, the means of implementing it must be an integral part of any United Nations plan, and that implementation might possibly involve the use of force. If that aspect of the matter received little place in the General Assembly's resolution, we were not to blame. Britain has always regarded the United Nations as the basis of its international policy. We did not oppose the General Assembly's decision. Indeed, we are collaborating in the orderly transfer of authority to the United Nations Commission. Surely it would be criminal for us to allow all the work of the past 25 years to be undone. Our desire is to see the continuance of conditions in Palestine which will ensure the people's progress and happiness. Let no one imagine that the situation in Palestine is other than grim. Acting with complete impartiality, British troops have so far prevented open civil war. But elements on both sides have resorted to violence, and the normal services of the administration are being maintained under conditions of the utmost difficulty. Whatever arms there may be in Palestine, each side wants more. Further additions only make the conflagration worse. The Palestine government has maintained control over the importation of arms, whether by Arabs or by Jews. It has prevented clashes, held back and dispersed intruders, and tried to maintain order. At the same time, while exercising ultimate control as a mandatory power, it has allowed each community to form police forces and make other defensive arrangements. And, in order to facilitate the approaching transfer of authority, it is devolving upon those communities increased responsibility for local services and good order. I fear that all too little attention has been paid by world public opinion to those important positive measures taken by the Palestine authorities. I repudiate any suggestion that the administration is showing partiality to one side at the expense of the other. Both sides complain equally of our impartiality. The Palestine government has a heavy and complicated task until May 15. It must maintain its services, keep the economic life of the community going, wind up its administration, and evacuate British troops and stores. All this under the constant threat of violence and civil war. It is this background which explains why the mandatory power has not been able to meet the Commission on certain items of the Assembly's resolution. Questions like a free port, Jewish militia, longer overlap for the Commission before May 15 are essentially matters of security. We have no lack of willingness to respect the policy of the United Nations. Our cooperation with the United Nations is already demonstrated, but we cannot implement the plan. The difficulties arise from the hard realities of the present situation in Palestine. And finally, what about an international force? The United Nations has not created one up to now. And Palestine now jumps to the front with its special problem. What the Security Council will do, I don't know. The time is short, and it is true that the prestige of the United Nations is being tested. But the United Kingdom has paid a great price in Palestine throughout the last quarter of a century. And whatever our responsibility for the present situation, a responsibility no less great and grave rests upon the other nations. The months roll on.
We return you now to Chicago.
Thank you, gentlemen. You have been listening to the University of Chicago Roundtable present five opinions on should a United Nations army enforce partition of Palestine. This is NBC, the national broadcasting company.